Hello again, Debbie back with part two of our reading of the Herald and Review e-edition on Wednesday, March 2nd, 2016, starting as usual with the death notices. Decatur, Lawrence, Mary Lou. Mary Lou Lawrence, 88, of Washington, Illinois, formerly of Decatur, passed away Saturday, February 27th, at Reflections Memory Care in Washington, Illinois. Funeral service to celebrate Mary's life will be 11 a.m. Thursday, March 3rd, at St. Paul's Lutheran Church. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to church service. Burial will be in Lana Cemetery in Chestnut, Illinois. Contributions may be made to St. Jude's Children's Hospital or St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Decatur. Decatur, Romer, Robert L. Robert L. Bob Romer, 79, in Decatur, passed away Monday, February 29th, 2016. Massive Christian burial to celebrate Bob's life will be at 9:30 a.m. Saturday, March 5th, 2016, at Our Lady of Lourdes Catholic Church, Reverend Richard Welton, celebrant. Visitation will begin at 4 p.m. Friday, March 4th, at Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Vigil prayer service will be at 3:30 p.m. Burial will be at Mount Pulaski Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials will be made to Central Illinois Down Syndrome, care of Team Alex Romer, Mount Pulaski Athletic Program, or Pet Care Van. Joyner, Floyd Lee, Decatur. Floyd Lee Joyner, 67, of Decatur, passed away Wednesday, February 24th, 2016, in Decatur Memorial Hospital. Homegoing services to celebrate Floyd's life will be 12 noon Saturday, March 5th, 2016, at Moran and Goble Funeral Home on Monroe Street in Decatur. Visitation will be from 6 to 8 p.m. Friday, March 4th, Funeral Home. Interment will be at Greenwood Cemetery. Decatur, Streety Harriet B. Harriet B. Streety, 78, of Decatur, passed away peacefully at Lincolnshire Memory Care Unit on Sunday, February 28th, 2016. Mass of Christian burial will be celebrated at 10 a.m. Saturday, March 5th, at St. Patrick Catholic Church with Reverend John Burnett as celebrant. Visitation will be from 9 to 10 on Saturday before the service. Burial will be in Graceland Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the Alzheimer's Research Foundation. Decatur, Walker, Barbara Jean. Barbara Jean Walker, 77, Phoenix, Arizona, formerly of Decatur, retired from Bridgetown Firestone, Inc., passed away peacefully Thursday, February 25th, 2016. Services noon Friday, Historic Tanner Chapel, AME Church, Phoenix. Visitation 6 to 8 Thursday, Universal South Mountain Mortuary, Phoenix. Decatur, Walker, Ida M. Ida M. Lake Walker, 84, of Decatur, departed this life on Monday, February 29th, 2016, at McKinley Court Nursing Home. She was a loving mother of Roger E. Walker, Jr., deceased, Pastor Thomas Margaret Walker, Arthur Lee, Terry Walker, Hilda Walker, all of Decatur, and Timothy Lake of Danville. Visitation Friday, March 4th, 2016, 5 to 8 at Main Street Church, 2000 North Main Street. Funeral service 12 noon Saturday, March 5th at Main Street Church with visitation 1 hour before service. Burial Graceland Cemetery. And a death notice for Mount Zion, Boehner Kenneth John. Kenneth John Boehner, 61, of Mount Zion, formerly of Ford City, Pennsylvania, passed away Wednesday, February 24th, 2016. Ken was born September 27th, 1954, in Kittanning, Pennsylvania. That is the end of that notice. Decatur, Cummings, Bessie May. Bessie Mae Cummings, 96, of Decatur, passed away on February 25th, 2016, at Decatur Memorial Hospital. Services celebrating her life will be held. The visitation 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, March 4th, at Walker Funeral Service with memorial rites by the Order of the Eastern Star, St. Mary's Chapter Number 65, at 6 p.m. Funeral Service, 11 a.m. Saturday. Okay. This is written in a different style, and I am sorry. Let me start over again. Services celebrating her life will be held. The visitation is 5 to 7, Friday, March 4th, at Walker Funeral Service with memorial rites by the Order of Eastern Star St. Mary's Chapter at 6 p.m. The funeral service will be held 11 a.m. Saturday, March 5th, at New Salem Baptist Church with visitation 1 hour before service. Burial, Graceland Cemetery. And the last notice in this paper today, Decatur, Ryan, Michael Fenton. Michael Fenton Ryan, 91, of Decatur, Illinois, formerly of Munster, Indiana, passed away on Sunday, February 28th at Decatur Memorial Hospital, Decatur, Illinois. There is a memorial service at the First Baptist Church of Decatur on Arbor Drive in Decatur on Thursday, March 3rd, 11 a.m., with a luncheon to immediately follow. End of that notice and the end of the obituaries for today. The beginning of this section, the life section, is health med fit. Reaction time is crucial in a medical emergency. The headline reads, Teaching Kids to Act Fast. This is by Justin Kahn of the Herald and Review, Decatur. When Karen Schnellner asked the fourth grade students in Carla Diorti's class at Oak Grove Elementary School to raise their hands if they'd heard of a stroke, nearly every hand went up. When Schneller asked if someone in the class could describe what a stroke looked like, 10-year-old William Jones raised his head and said, It's when someone's scared and their head's hurt. Schneller said, No, that's more like a heart attack, then spent the next few minutes explaining to students what a stroke was, what the effects are, and what they should do if they saw someone having it. Schneller is Decatur Memorial Foundation director, but was a nurse for 40 years, most of that time in Decatur. 2.5 years ago, she started a community outreach program for children in which she educates fourth grade classes in an attempt to help them save a life if they witness a stroke. Community education is a big deal to me, but when I found out we didn't have any education for kids, Schneller said. Children often stay with older adults and grandparents after school. We found that fourth grade was a good target. They're engaged and ask good questions. Schneller's presentation lasts around 30 minutes. She explained to the class if the cells in the brain don't receive oxygen, they die. Schneller told them there are two things that can cause oxygen to not reach the brain, a clog or a leak. And if oxygen isn't reaching the brain, regions that control speech or movement of certain parts of the body shut down. Schneller gave the students an acronym to remember, FAST, F-A-S-T, which stands for face, arm, speech, and time. With face, you know that feeling you get in your mouth at the dentist when they put medicine there? That's what it looks like. Their face gets droopy. Arm is, let's say you're coloring together and they drop the crayon and can't pick it up. Speech is if you're talking and you suddenly can't understand them. Their words are garbled. Time means react quickly, because the more time passes, the more cells die. Schneller asked the class, what can you do to act fast? Walk them to the hospital, Jones said. Well, they might not be able to walk there, Schneller said. Call 911, said 9-year-old Autumn Roy. That's exactly right. Schneller told the class the risk factors for stroke and then handed out story time and coloring books she'd created called A Child's Guide to Being a Hero, Know What to Do in an Emergency. The character Ben in the book is named after her now-grown son, and a character Marla is Ben's girlfriend. Schneller asked the class if they had any questions, and 10-year-old Adonis Williams raised his hand. If their brain cells die, how do they get better? Williams said. Schneller said if a stroke victim can get to the hospital quickly, the doctors can give them medicine that will unclot their blood so oxygen can be delivered to their brain before too many cells die. Schneller finished by asking the students if they could do some homework for her. I know you don't like homework, but I want you to take that book home tonight and read it to two adults, Schneller said. 10-year-old Abigail Regan raised her hand. Yes, you can, Schneller said. That counts. Later, concern was raised by some students what to do if the cell phone they were trying to use call was locked. John's hand snapped in the air. If you borrow someone's phone and it's locked, you can press emergency and dial 911, Jones said. That's a good point, William, Schneller said. End of that article. Next article on page one of the life section. Cancer Institutes endorse HPV vaccine. This is by Justin Kahn again. In response to low rates of U.S. citizens getting HPV vaccinations, last month, 68 leading National Cancer Institute designated cancer centers issued a joint statement publicly endorsing HPV vaccination for cancer prevention. Approximately 79 million people in the U.S. are currently infected with the human papillomavirus, HPV, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and 14 million new infections occur every year. Several types of high-risk HPV are responsible for the vast majority of cervical, anal, oropharyngeal, middle throat, and other genital cancers. The CDC also reports that each year in the U.S., 27,000 men and women are diagnosed with HPV-related cancer, which amounts to a new case every 20 minutes. It's not often that we have an opportunity to prevent cancer, and in this case, multiple cancers, with a single tool, said Dr. Debbie Saslow, American Cancer Society Director of Cancer Control Intervention, HPV, and Women's Cancers. The NCI Cancer Center's joint statement encouraged, and there's three bullet points here, all parents and guardians have their sons and daughters complete the three-dose HPV vaccine series before their 13th birthday and complete the series as soon as possible in children aged 13 to 17. Parents and guardians should talk to their health care provider to learn more about HPV vaccines and their benefits. Point two, young men up to 21 and young women up to 26 who were not vaccinated as preteens or teens should complete the three-dose HPV vaccine series. And point three, all healthcare providers to be advocates for cancer prevention by making strong recommendations for childhood HPV vaccination. According to a 2015 CDC report, only 40% of girls and 21% of boys in the U.S. are receiving the vaccine, falling well short of the goal of 80% by the end of this decade set forth by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Children as young as 9 are eligible for the vaccine. U.S. rates are significantly lower than those of countries such as Australia, 75%, the United Kingdom, 84% to 92%, and Rwanda, 93%, which have shown that high vaccination rates are achievable. End of that article. Continuing in the life section, patient moves prosthetic fingers with mime. This is by Andrea Michaels, Tribune News Service writer. This is out of Baltimore, Maryland. After Darth Vader lopped off Luke Skywalker's hand in the movie The Empire Strikes Back, Rebel Alliance doctors installed a prosthetic that immediately moves and feels just like a human hand. Science fiction is coming closer to reality at Johns Hopkins, where researchers recently adapted a brain mapping technology to enable a patient to independently move individual fingers on a prosthetic arm just by thinking about it. Wow. Well, such technology is years from practical application in patients. The breakthrough by biomedical engineers and physicians from the Johns Hopkins University and its School of Medicine is the latest advancement in a growing field of research into mind-controlled movements of artificial limbs. The Johns Hopkins researchers said their work, published this month in the Journal of Neural Engineering, is the first to accomplish such precise, individualized motion of the fingers and shows promise for one day providing amputees with prosthetics that more closely mimic the movements of real hands and arms. While prosthetics have improved in recent years, they still can be bulky and hard to maneuver. The fingers on existing prosthetics move as one unit or in unison, opening and closing together, like when grasping a soda can. We still have a bit of ways to go before we can get this in a practical clinical setting, fully restoring the natural dexterity of people. But I think that day is coming, said Guy Hodson, an electrical and computing engineering graduate student at Johns Hopkins, who was lead author on the study. There are more than 100,000 people in the United States with amputated hands or arms who could potentially benefit from such prosthetics, according to the Amputee Coalition, an education support and advocacy organization. The mind control research is very cutting edge, said George Gondo, the coalition's director of research and grants. It's really exciting to see improvement and to see actual results from the research. Funded by the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, the experiment used a modular prosthetic arm developed by Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory. Considered the world's most sophisticated upper extremity prosthesis, the arm can perform almost all the same movements as a human arm and hand. The lab's research and development of the arm itself was funded under the Revolutionizing Prosthetics Program at Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, with the intent of restoring limb function to wounded military members. While building such a mechanically sophisticated prosthesis is possible, how to control it remains an open question. That's where the Johns Hopkins researcher thought that brain mapping technology, known as electrocardiography, could be used. Electrocorticography could be used, but they needed a subject to whom they could apply sensitive electrodes directly to the brain. Because the study involved opening the brain, the researchers needed to find someone already getting surgery for something else, so they recruited a young epileptic man undergoing brain surgery to stop seizures not controlled by medicine. As part of the procedure, doctors place electrodes on the patient's brain to help determine where his seizure oriented and then remove those parts of his brain. The surgeons apply the same mapping technique to determine which parts of his brain controlled finger movement. A set of 128 electrodes sitting on a film the size of a credit card were placed on the parts of the brain that control hand and arm movement. Each sensor measured a millimeter of brain tissue. The researchers then asked the patient, who was awake throughout the surgery, to move individual fingers. The computer program developed by Johns Hopkins engineers recorded the parts of the brain that were activated through electrical signals detected by the sensors as he moved each finger. Researchers also tracked which parts of the brain responds to sensory input from the fingers by having the patient wear a glove with vibrating buzzers on each finger and measuring the subsequent electrical activity. Using the data collected from the patient's brain, the prosthetic arm was programmed to move particular fingers when corresponding parts of the brain were activated. The amputee Coalition's Gondo said motion control technology has the potential to improve the lives of amputees, from the types of jobs they do to their ability to live independently. Even if the technology is perfected for mind control prosthetics, cost remains a huge obstacle for widespread application. A modular prosthetic can cost $500,000, said Hudson. It will be interesting to see how and if they're able to bring any of this technology to market. That's always a challenge, Gondo said, particularly with upper limb prosthetics because it's such a small percentage of the population. It could be years before mind-controlled prosthetics are even ready for commercialization, the Hopkins researcher said. We're not going to see this in patients right away, Groen said. They're just the first steps towards that technology. End of that article. Okay. That is the end of that life section. Switching to the Decatur Tribune Online, Paul Osborne, editor, will go over his city beat. Citizen wants review of downtown handicap parking. Betty Wheatley dropped a letter by our newspaper office last week that she'd mailed to the City of Decatur offices on January 30th. Since she hadn't received a reply in a month, Betty wanted to know. Since she hadn't received a reply in a month, Betty wanted to make her appeal for review of downtown handicap parking known to our readers. Perhaps the downtown handicap spaces need to be reviewed, as there have been many changes in our downtown businesses. There are no handicap spots in the whole block of Merchant Street, but a number of great businesses for food. There should be one handicap spot in the middle of the block on the east side of the street. Number two, the first parking space on the south side of William at North Main Street should be handicapped so they don't have to cross a very busy street to get to any business in that whole block between William and Prairie. There are a number of great restaurants in that block. Trying to hurry across Route 51 from the parking lot on the east side of the street is not easy sometimes. Three, there is one handicap parking spot in the parking lot off of East Main Street just south of Route 51, South Main Corner, but it is of the Route 51 South Main Corner, but it's about four spaces into the parking lot. Why isn't the first space the handicap spot? That's the spot which needs to be more accessible. Thank you for the review of this matter, she concluded in her letter to the city. Next item. Unrelated to that one, the city of Decatur and city manager Tim Gleason filed a motion last Thursday to have a lawsuit dismissed that was filed against them by fired police chief Brad Sweeney. In Sweeney's lawsuit, he's seeking reinstatement and punitive damages. One interesting twist in the motion dismiss is that if Sweeney's allegations are true, that Gleason illegally used a police vehicle to transport him to the St. Louis airport in May because of a scheduling problem at Mayor Mike McElroy's suggestion, and Sweeney felt the action was illegal but allowed it, then Sweeney was not only participating in the offense but did not arrest the city manager for breaking the law. Gleason contends he had no knowledge that the police vehicle use was a problem or that Sweeney had an issue until after he was fired. There's a lot more in the motion that explains the side of the city of Decatur and city manager. W. Soy had the document posted on its website, and it is, to me, an interesting read. But the filing of the lawsuit by Sweeney and the subsequent motion to dismiss by the city of Decatur and Gleason has gone so far to give the city manager an opportunity to explain his side of the story, because he couldn't do previously because it's a personnel matter. I don't know if the judge will deny the motion to dismiss, but even if the judge doesn't dismiss it, Gleason, due to the legal action against him and the city of Decatur, has been able to give some of his side of the story. Most of the time, unless a lawsuit is filed, people in positions like city manager are unable to respond publicly to allegations against them and personnel managers. Next article, or commentary. I was stopped in the drive-up lane of Dairy Queen the other day when the driver of the car in front of me, who was at the drive-up window, put out his arm out the window with a handful of scrap paper and dropped the paper in the driveway. It's probably a good thing that I was restrained by the seatbelt. When drivers throw papers and other refuse out their windows onto the ground for someone else to clean up, I wonder how they were even smart enough to pass the driver's license test to drive a car. I know that to a lot of people, for me to be bothered by some drivers littering is a little over the top, considering big issues like our world, hunger, ISIS, etc. However, I think we need to change the world where we are and improve our community. There are things that each of us can do to make our community better, and they should be natural, no-brainer items, such as no dumping trash out your car window. If you don't want your trash, what makes you think the rest of the community wants to look at it? I was going to go out and pick up his trash and put it in the trash barrel not far away, but it blew all over the place and down the street. Probably this driver was one of those people who always complains about how the city looks. The sad part is that I believe many people who are trashers never give it a second thought. It's such a simple thing to do. Don't throw your trash out of your car window. That it's hard to believe that anybody would do it. Oh, well, onward and upward to a greater Decatur, Illinois. End of that. Decatur Tribune also has a couple of scam alerts for Macon County. Scam alert for Macon County Sheriff's Office. Man calling residents saying he has a warrant for their arrest. The Macon County Sheriff's Office is now receiving calls regarding a male subject calling residents, identifying himself as a deputy from our office, saying they have a warrant for their arrest and they either need to call him back or turn themselves into our office. The phone number shows up in the caller's ID, starts with 217-620 and followed by various other numbers. If the subject leaves a voicemail, he says to call him back with an extension to dial. As of yet, we have not received any calls indicating the subject is requesting money, since most of the calls have either been left on a voicemail or the residents have hung up on the subject. This is a scam. Do not fall for the scam. We do not randomly call people and tell them they have a warrant. If residents have received this call, they can call the Macon County Elder Abuse Hotline at 615-7582. If they've fallen victim to this and sent money to the subject, please contact your local law enforcement agency to file a formal complaint. Then the next one is Sheriff's Office issues jury duty scam alert for Macon County. The Macon County Sheriff's Office has started receiving calls regarding the jury duty scam going around Decatur and Macon County. The caller is a male who's identifying himself by different names but saying he's from the Macon County Sheriff's Office. The caller is telling people they missed jury duty and need to get green dot cards to pay off the fine or face arrest. This is a scam. Do not be a victim. If you received this call and have made a payment to the individual, please contact your local law enforcement agency to file a report. If you simply received a call, you can call the Macon County Elder Abuse Hotline at 615-7582, 615-7582. For additional information on other well-known scams, click on the Elder Abuse Hotline and Scams tab under Notes on the Macon County Sheriff's Office Facebook page. At this point, the Sheriff's Office received about a dozen phone calls regarding this scam in one day, and so far, no one has fallen victim to it. End of that. End of what we're reading out of the Decatur Tribune, too. In agriculture, Stu Ellis. Buffett puts Conservation Center page for the Stu Ellis for the Herald and Review. Although the U.S. Department of Agriculture dismal projections for grain markets and the farm economy got most of the headlines last week at the annual Outlook Forum in Washington, it may have been Howard Buffett who offered the most poignant take-home messages. The global farmer and philanthropist shared the stage with Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack for his chat about conservation. He leveled his sights, took aim, and fired a magnum clip of quotable Howardisms, telling the international audience that, quote, soil is an amazing living ecosystem. If you treat it like dirt, that's what you'll get, unquote. Well, none in the audience had more mud on their boots than did Buffett. His place in the big stage allowed the USDA to raise soil conservation issues to the highest level. Addressing Vilsack, Buffett said, quote, the greatest legacy you leave behind is that you put conservation on the map, and I hope it stays there, unquote. USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service will use $5 to $6 billion annually to avert the loss of soil and to promote high-quality water with a myriad of programs. The conversation with Buffett was the first time in memory that soil conservation was addressed in the opening session of the two-day conference, and it preempted such important issues as diminishing trade and the weakening farm economy. If policymakers were listening, and several congressional aides were in attendance, the chat with Buffett could have been a USDA masterstroke toward elevating soil conservation and farm environmental issues as Congress begins work on the next farm bill. He offers many catchphrases in that direction, including, quote, if you give farmers the right opportunities for conservation, they can do it and they will. And, quote, agriculture isn't changing fast enough to avoid more government regulations, unquote. Well, many Corn Belt farmers are moving in the general direction of conserving soil, protecting water quality, and utilizing existing soil biology to boost yields. Buffett is already there when he says, quote, when you see soil erosion, sedimentation, water quality, and then you see effective drought, then no-till and cover crops become easy. And he added, you can pay for cover crops when you see the difference of 25 bushels of corn per acre. Well, Buffett has to be all business in dealing with the family business investments. He's applying those same principles to everyday farming. From a business standpoint, it was a smart decision to employ conservation practices. It doesn't work well economically to do the kind of rotations we really should do to protect our land and soil. That's the challenge. We need government incentives to get farmers away from the corn-bean rotation. Unquote. The globe-trotting philanthropist has had the opportunities to see the impact of U.S. agriculture on the rest of the world, and he is thrilled with the positive results. U.S. farmers have saved tons of millions of acres of biodiverse jungles and forests because of efficient, high-yielding production agriculture. Considering the alternative in which farmers in many foreign nations have no conservation priorities, Buffett said, biodiversity is underrated and American farmers are the best conservationists. As farmers head to the field this year to produce a crop that will cost more than it will return, Buffett's observations about his fertility practices will get some attention, particularly with high yields and half of the typical nitrogen application. He told the USDA audience that he raised 227 bushel corn on 160 acres, applying just 100 pounds of nitrogen fertilizer per acre. I'm very competitive with yields, but spend significantly less. Wherever he goes, Buffett cuts a wide swath, and it certainly didn't hurt when he said, I learned a huge amount about farming from Nebraska Cooperative Extension and couldn't have done it without them. There's no way we could be where we are without land-grant universities. End of that article. End of part two of the Decatur reading of the online edition. This is Debbie on March 2nd, 2016, saying, talk to you again next week.